We now go to interviewer Pat Morse, who talks with Scotford Simonu about his struggle for freedom and justice in his native Zimbabwe and now here in the United States.
Scotford, you've been in this country about 15 or 16 years or so?
Yeah, I've been in this country for about 16 years.
You came here, what, around 1985?
I came to the United States in 1987.
1987?
Yeah.
And you're from Zimbabwe originally?
Yeah, I'm from Zimbabwe.
And what brought you to the United States?
Basically, it's the situation, in the political situation in Zimbabwe. My father was murdered in mysterious circumstances in Zimbabwe in 1984. And we had this feeling that the government of Robert Mugabe was behind it. At that time, my brother was working at the United Nations, so we decided to leave the country and come to the United States.
So Robert Mugabe is the president of Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
He's actually been the only president that Zimbabwe has ever had.
Exactly. He's been leading the country now for over 25 years. Zimbabwe got independent in 1980, April 18, 1980, so that's 25 years now. He's been the only leader who's been in Zimbabwe. He's always been a crushing opposition, and anybody who lifted his head to oppose him would either get destroyed politically or he would send his secret assassins to go and eliminate him. My father was one of the most vocal critics of Robert Mugabe and his style of governing.
Going back just a few years before your father was assassinated, Zimbabwe is the former Rhodesia, was once a British colony.
Yeah, Zimbabwe, yeah, was once a British colony. It was under colonial rule for over 50 years. The British colonized Zimbabwe in the 16th or 17th century. At the time when Mugabe was, they called him a terrorist when he was fighting for freedom, Zimbabwe was being run by Ian Smith as the Prime Minister of Zimbabwe.
At that time, Robert Mugabe was considered a hero by the native people of Zimbabwe.
Yeah, he was considered a hero because he took up arms against the British colonial rulers. He waged a war for independence, and at the time of independence, he was actually considered a hero because of the great effort he did in ending the colonial rule of Rhodesia.
And then once the British were gone, Mugabe took power. Was he elected originally?
Yeah, he was at the end of the war. He was very, very popular because he was seen as someone who had brought about democracy, brought about freedom. And under the supervision of the British, they conducted free and fair elections in 1980. Mugabe won unanimously because he was seen as a hero, and he was definitely a hero at that time.
That changed over the years. He kept getting reelected, though, isn't that right? I mean, he was just recently reelected to another term.
Yeah. Well, Mugabe was a very popular figure in the world at the time of independence, especially because of his policy of reconciliation. He sought to unite the people of Zimbabwe who were divided along ethnical and racial lines. And he was credited by the international community for extending a hand of reconciliation, trying to rebuild Zimbabwe together with the British colonial rulers. And he was seen as a guy who had embraced the democratic principles. But as time went on, he started getting entrenched, using the government apparatus to entrench himself with a lot of powers. And that was seen when he rewrote the constitution. He changed the constitution. At the time of independence, he was elected as prime minister. He changed the constitution and made himself the executive president. He started passing laws that were bent on suppressing democracy. He started oppressing the media, started putting to jail people who wrote things that were very negative about himself, and he started just pursuing policies that were aimed at creating a one-party state.
What do you think brought all that about, Scotford? I mean, he was a very popular hero. right after Zimbabwe won its liberation from Great Britain. I mean, why would he need to, you know, institute these essentially ruthless ways to stay in power?
I think as time went on, he started mismanaging the economy of Zimbabwe. Most recently, his policies of land redistribution, he started grabbing mostly white-owned farms in Zimbabwe by force and redistributing the land to landless blacks. But what it actually did, it actually destroyed the economy of Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is one of the leading exporters of tobacco, which is a major foreign currency. When he took away these farms from the white farmers, he basically brought down the production. You know, Zimbabwe was once considered the breadbasket of Southern Africa. These policies just started running the economy down. At this moment, right now, as we speak, inflation is over 60%, unemployment is over 70%. The Zimbabwe dollar keeps on falling rapidly against the U.S. dollar. It's just a terrible situation. During the, his third re-election, he actually was condemned by the Western that he was rigging the elections. He was using government apparatus to rig the elections. And he's very, very unpopular right now. And right now, he doesn't accept international observers during election times. He does not allow even the British or the United Nations or any other independent groups from outside to monitor the elections. So he's really just entrenched himself. And right now, I think he's scared of getting out of power because he's committed a lot of atrocities.
And moving it just a few years ahead from the Zimbabwe independence, your father was a politician. He was critical of Mugabe's tactics or his policies. You feel Mugabe had your father killed because of his criticism.
Yeah, I feel like Mugabe had a lot to do with my father's death, because my father was not the only victim. He had a pattern of destroying people who are critical of his way of running the country. A lot of people disappeared mysteriously. Just before independence, one of the well-celebrated heroes of Zimbabwe, his name was Josiah Tongogara, he was a general in the army, and he was one of the people who did not agree with Mugabe on a lot of things, and he died in a mysterious accident just before independence. And a lot of people who came out trying to push for a balanced constitution that allowed for democratic principles to flourish were targeted, because Mugabe was writing the constitution to ensure he stayed in power forever. In other words, he was just basically trying to turn the country into a one-party state. Anybody who criticized was either killed or disappeared mysteriously. And my father, I'm very positive, he was one of the victims. And when we tried to push for an investigation, my brother, who was working at the United Nations, tried to push for an investigation. He was threatened. His wife at one time was raped in Washington, D.C. With his senior. Our family was just threatened that something would happen to us if we kept on pushing for our father's investigation. They just wanted us to just stay out of the issue and just act as if nothing happened, but we wouldn't let go.
How exactly were you and your family threatened, Scottford?
Well, one of the people who were very close to my father told my mother we should watch our backs about this issue of investigating the death of our father. You know, once word got out that he was talking to my mother, he also disappeared mysteriously.
This former friend of your father's?
Exactly. His name was Robson Manyika. He was a member of the government. He was in the same party. He was a politician. He was very close to my father.
And what was your father's name?
My father's name was Peter Josford Simunyu.
Was he a member of Mugabe's party, ZANU-PF?
Yeah, he was a member of ZANU-PF. You know, he joined the party at the time when it was very popular, and it won a lot of praise throughout the world. But he would just want to make sure that everything ran according to the principles of democracy. He just challenged every move that was aimed at that was seen as a power-grabbing scheme aimed at entrenching Mugabe with all the powers that he wanted. So he was more like trying to make sure it was a balanced system, open for constructive criticism.
So at some point after your father was killed, you and your family decided that it was no longer safe for you in Zimbabwe, and you left.
Exactly. I left at the time when my family was under threat. Up to now, my family lives in fear, and it's kind of very hard for us to pursue those investigations because of the threats that were persistently laid upon us.
Have you or any of your family been threatened while you were in this country?
In 1999, we tried to form an organization here in the United States. Mugabe did send some people from the United Nations Embassy to just watch what was going on, and we just felt at that time we were being threatened. A lot of people just didn't want to get involved in any organization because they were just afraid that these agents might pass information that will harm their families back home in Zimbabwe.
You felt threatened by the mere presence of these agents?
Right.
Scott, after you came to this country, what did you do then?
Well, I went to UMass for 2 years. I dropped out at that time because I couldn't afford the tuition. I joined the BAE system for 5 years, where I worked as a programmer. I was programming chips for the military.
You were actually working for BAE Systems when you were arrested in 2001?
Yeah, I was working for BAE Systems, a defense contractor based in Nashua, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the incident of your arrest?
Soon after 9/11, the Department of Immigration was going after people who were in this country illegally, especially those who had deportation orders. At that time, I was living with my brother, who at that time had a deportation order.
You were living with your brother?
Right.
Who had been ordered?
Deported.
Now, is this the brother that worked for the embassy?
That's my brother that worked for the United Nations, yeah, embassy, yeah.
Why was he ordered deported if he was working for the Zimbabwe government at the United Nations?
He was working for the Zimbabwe government, the United Nations, and then his contract expired and he went back to Zimbabwe. And because he feared for his safety in Zimbabwe, and he was jailed at one time, was beaten by Mugabe's agents in Zimbabwe, and then he fled to this country in 1995. When he got here, his wife could not follow him, so he tried to bring his wife to this country, and that's when he got in trouble with immigration. When he failed to bring his wife, the immigration department decided to order him deported because he didn't go to court for that case. So after 9/11, they were looking for people who had been ordered deported, and my brother was one of them.
And what's his name?
His name is Stanford Simunyu.
And he was ordered deported, and immigration was looking for him.
And I happened to be home at that time. They asked for my papers, and I told them my visa had expired, and they took me in. When I went for my bail hearing, Judge Ragno just denied me bail.
That's Judge Thomas Ragno.
Yeah.
So they weren't even looking for you. Immigration wasn't looking for you. They were looking for your brother. You happened to be essentially at the wrong place, the wrong time.
Exactly. That's what exactly happened.
And you were picked up by the immigration authorities and brought before immigration judge Thomas Ragno.
Although I had a good track record of someone who paid taxes and had a job, and I've been here for almost 16 years at that time, he still denied me. I just felt like that he was just hell-bent on trying to get me deported, and I decided to fight because I didn't see any reason why.
And did you apply for political asylum at that time?
Yes, I did apply for political asylum, and normally the political asylum cases, they take about 6 months. Judge Ragno extended the asylum hearing for over 2 years. He asked for every document to prove that my father was killed. He wanted to see testimony from my sister, who was in Indiana doing a master's in clinical psychology. He wanted to see the death certificate of my father. He wanted to see the autopsy of my father. He wanted to see newspaper clips of my father's death. Everything was provided.
So this all dragged out the process.
Exactly.
And in the meantime, he ordered you held without bail while all this was going on.
Exactly.
That whole process took how long, Scottford?
The whole process took about 2 years. I appealed. The appeal took another 6 months. I won my appeal. At that time when I won my appeal, Judge Thomas Ragno was exposed in the media, especially in the Globe and the Herald, that he was being racist and being very unfair to immigrants, especially those from Africa.
Those are Boston papers.
The Boston papers, yeah. And he was cited as calling this lady from Uganda. He was addressing her, saying, "Hey, Jane, this is Judge Tarzan," using racist remarks. And when I was going before him, too, he joked with prosecutors, saying that, "Hey, you guys, have you ever seen that movie, Hang Them High? Oh, I love that movie." And the prosecutors would just laugh. And
so he was implying that he was going to hang you high.
Exactly, that's what he implied.
How much would you estimate that you've spent on attorney's fees up to this point?
I would estimate about over $12,000.
Over $12,000. Yeah. And almost 2.5 years in jail.
Exactly.
Where are you at right now with your appeal for political asylum, with your money situation, with your job situation? What's the current status?
Well, when I won my appeal, and thanks a lot to Pat, who I met at Rockingham Jail, you did a very good job writing the support. I did hire another attorney because my first attorney did seem like he was incompetent, and we hired a new attorney. The bail was set at $10,000 surety and $2,000 cash.
So you had to come up with...
I had to come up
with $2,000, right, for the bail bondsman. And that's money that you won't see ever again one way or another, right, whether you're released or deported or whatever.
Exactly. Right now, as a condition of my release, I'm not allowed to work. My immigration attorney said that if there's no petition right now that's active, there's no way I could apply for a work permit, so I'm not allowed to work until I go to court next year in 2006 in April.
Next April.
Yeah, so right now I have to come up with the money for my attorney. I owe him right now $3,500. Just a week ago, we got a letter from the bail bonds company. They want $500 to renew the bail bonds. And I'm not allowed to work, so I really need the financial support to keep my case alive and hopefully prevail at my next hearing.
So right now you need about $4,000 just to stay alive, you might say.
Yeah, I need $4,000.
If you don't come up with money for your attorney or money for the bondsman?
My bail will be revoked, and INS can come and arrest me and put me in custody again.
How do they expect somebody like you to survive? You know, essentially you've lost your job. You were in jail for a couple of years, so you've more or less lost your network of friends and support. You've been ordered not to work. How do you survive?
Yeah, those are, I think, some of the problems with the legal system. I definitely think it needs to be reviewed. I don't know how they expect me to pay for my attorney if they tell me I can't work. You know, to survive in this country, you need to have an income. And right now, I have no choice but to appeal for the people out there for the support, financial support, to do the fundraising for me. But I just feel that there's something definitely wrong with the system. I think the system should provide for a way for someone to really sustain himself financially. And right now I'm kind of in a limbo situation. I just have to go out there and ask for support from people who support me. But otherwise, there's no other way I can support myself.
You have skills. You're not disabled?
I'm not disabled. I have skills. The record shows very clearly that I worked all the years I've been here. I worked as a programmer. I worked as a mechanical assembly admission operator. I've done a lot of different things, and the record is very clear. But still, I don't understand why they wouldn't let me work. But that's what the situation is right now until my next court hearing.
Well, Scottford, thank you for taking the time for this interview. What's next in your future? Are you going to go job hunting?
Hopefully, but we're talking about a year from now. But all I just say to the people out there that this is my situation. Get a hold of me. If they want to email me, they can email me at scottsimonio@yahoo.com. So,
could you spell that out, Scott?
SCOTTSIMUNYU. @yahoo.com.
@yahoo.com.
Yeah.
So it's SCOTTSIMUNYU @yahoo.com.
Right.
And that's your email.
That's my email.
Okay. And we also have a special bank account set up for Scotford, and it's the Scotford Simoneau Defense Fund. And if you can make a donation, we ask that you make your checks payable to Seacoast Peace Response /SSDF. And you can mail that to Seacoast Peace Response, Post Office Box 863, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, 03801.
Would you harbor me? Would I harbor you? Would you harbor me? Would I harbor you? Would you harbor a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a heretic, convict, or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a person living with AIDS? Would you harbor a Tubman, a Garrett, a Truth, a fugitive, or a slave? Would you harbor a Haitian, Korean, or Czech, a lesbian, or a gay? Would you harbor a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a heretic, convict, or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a person living with AIDS? Would you harbor a Tubman, a Garrett, a Truth, a fugitive, or a slave? Would you harbor a Haitian, Korean, or Czech, a lesbian, or a gay? Would you
harbor me? We now hear from Adam Brodsky with Uncivil Rights.
Hey, Mr. President, you can have my civil rights. Just leave me one or two to use when I go out Friday night. Lots of evildoers out there who hate democracy, so we must give up our freedom to preserve our liberty. Well, you should question my neighbor, search his place, take him downtown. He's either Buddhist or he's Muslim, I forget, but hey, he's brown. Either way, what I'm trying to say is he ain't like me and you. And listen here, why should I fear? You know everybody loves the Jews. Well, stop me on the highway, search my car and my cavity, delve into my past like I'm a Supreme Court nominee. If I don't got nothing to hide, then why should I complain? And if I don't like it, I can always go live with Castro or Hussein. Hey, Mr. Cheney, you can have my civil rights. Just leave me one or two to use when I go out Friday night. Lots of evildoers out there who hate democracy, so we must give up our freedom to preserve our liberty. Well, I'm a real American, bought a little flag to prove I ain't no commie fascist Muslim pinko fag. I hang it on my window to show how much I care. Just don't ask me if I owned it when them big buildings still stood there. Well, I'm an atheist, so I won't get pissed if you take away Amendment the First and freedom of the press. Well, who do I look like? William Randolph Hearst. Peaceable assembly, redressing grievances. Boy, that sounds like hippie talk. We don't need your words, man. Ain't you heard all the doves have turned to hawks? Well, I love the Constitution, but we need a new addition. Not a total demolition, just a small redefinition. Let's commit to the mission, make a couple small additions, like the use of intuition to declare the opposition. Some thumbing through the articles, I offer admonition at the dangerous omission of a law against sedition. Needn't be a politician or a nuclear technician to make a requisition for a couple new submissions. I heard Mr. Bush say there's a new kind of war out there. Apparently it's the kind you don't gotta get Congress to declare. I heard Mr. Lott say there ain't no minority. Then he stared at Mr. Gephardt, who nodded sheepishly. Hey, Mr. Ashcroft, you can have my civil rights. Just leave me one or two to use when I go out Friday night. Lots of evil doers out there who hate democracy. So we must give up our freedom to preserve our liver, 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 preserve our liberty.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Adnan Rashid, a leader of the Iraqi Federation of Labor, who explains why he and other union activists oppose the ongoing U.S. military occupation of his country. Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, who discusses growing opposition to the U.S. military occupation of Iraq and plans for a large anti-war demonstration in Washington, D.C. this September. And Chris Levin of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who considers what's at stake for workers as the U.S. Congress debates ratification of the Central American Free Trade Agreement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Interpress Service reports that four investigators from the United Nations Human Rights Commission are seeking to visit the U.S. Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The group is looking to investigate allegations of torture, cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment of the detainees, officially called enemy combatants by the U.S. government. The UN body also wants to look into alleged violations of the right to health and the right to due process. The investigators plan to submit a full report to the UN Human Rights Commission at its next full session in Geneva in the spring of 2006. The UN investigators have not yet received a reply from the Bush administration on their request to visit Guantanamo Bay. Amnesty International has called the facility the gulag of our time. Former Presidents Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton have called for the closure of the detention center. The 500 detainees held in Guantanamo Bay have not been charged with any offense and are not recognized as prisoners of war. UN human rights investigator Paul Hunt of New Zealand says there are real concerns about the mental health condition of detainees at the facility, including reports of dozens of suicide attempts and tactics used like sleep deprivation. Hunt adds that a visit to Guantanamo is critical to finding out what the true conditions are at the prison. The Los Angeles Times reports that a decision by the CIA to fly Sudan's intelligence chief, Major General Salah Abdullah Gash, to Washington, D.C. for secret meetings met with strong resistance. Gash, who had allowed the CIA to question al-Qaeda suspects in Sudan, has been accused by human rights activists of being the chief planner for the wave of political violence in Darfur, which former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell condemned as genocide. Sudan remains on the State Department's list of state sponsors of terrorism. In late June, members of the Congressional Black Caucus sharply criticized the visit in a meeting with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Human rights activists have criticized the Bush administration for remaining silent on the atrocities in Darfur while increasing intelligence cooperation with Sudan. New Jersey Congressman Don Payne compared the visit by Gosch to inviting the head of the Nazi SS at the height of the Holocaust. Virginia Republican Representative Frank Wolf said, "This sends a very bad signal. Unless he's providing information that is going to save the Western world, it's hard to see how you can justify this." United Airlines bailed out on its union workforce in mid-May when a federal court allowed the airline to turn over its pension fund to the government-run Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. The Public Pension Board is left with responsibility to pay $9.8 billion in pension liabilities, the largest pension failure in 30 years. The deal could lead to more pension plan failures. It is also coming at the time when President George Bush continues to push for private accounts for Social Security. According to the news magazine In These Times, the survival of the pension plan is a huge issue for working Americans. More Americans rely on pension benefits than on Social Security for the bulk of their retirement income. Now, United joins 9,000 other pension plans that have been canceled since 2000. Over the last 4 years, the pension board has assumed the pension liabilities of 175,000 workers a year. Other big companies like Delta, Continental, and Greyhound are now thinking about scrapping their pension plans. All the new pension liabilities may force the Public Pension Board into bankruptcy. It is currently responsible for $62 billion in pension payments, but only has $39 billion in hard assets. Taxpayers may be forced to pay the difference. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
A network of more than 100 national, regional, and local groups called U.S. Labor Against the War sponsored the first-ever U.S. tour of Iraqi labor activists in June. Six representatives of three Iraqi labor federations visited 20 American cities with the goal of educating U.S. trade unionists about the conditions faced by Iraqi workers and their struggle to build direct worker-to-worker, union-to-union solidarity. The three federations represent a broad spectrum of the Iraqi labor movement, but all call for the withdrawal of U.S. and British occupation forces, and all are working to build a democratic, secular society in Iraq. Adnan Rashid, a mechanic and a leader of the Iraqi Federation of Labor, spoke in Hartford, Connecticut on June 22nd at the state headquarters of the Service Employees International Union, 1199. While stating that repression of labor was at its worst under Saddam Hussein, Rashid describes how U.S. military forces occupied his union offices for 8 months last year, evidence, he says, that repression of unions continues. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Rashid through a translator. He discusses the history of repression, current economic conditions, and the support that Iraqi union activists seek from their brothers and sisters in the U.S. labor movement.
The unions in Iraq have a history of about 80 years, and they've never seen a worse period in history than they have seen under Saddam Hussein. There were 12 federations of unions, and Saddam Hussein canceled six of them, and they were down to six federations. And the ones that he canceled are basically the public unions and left only the private sector, and the public union. Public labor force is, of course, the larger and more important labor force than the one that reflects public.
Were you glad to see Saddam Hussein overthrown by U.S. forces?
The removal of Saddam Hussein for us is an important nationalistic goal that was accomplished. And this removal of Saddam Hussein was helpful for ending a repression of the public in Iraq that has suffered significantly under his rule. If the change had happened through the Iraqi public in action, it would have been much, much more truthful to the nature of Iraq and to its interests if it had happened naturally and endogenously within Iraq rather than by external forces.
Do you support the occupation presently?
We do not support the occupation. We've never supported the occupation because it is an invasion of our country that had no reason and no justification.
Now, I'd like to know a little bit about what the situation is right now in Iraq with the U.S. occupation.
Our biggest concern is the economic situation, which has deteriorated rapidly under the current administration. And we hope that there will be change in the economy such that we will reopen a lot of the worker force and allow more workers into the labor force. Most projects in Iraq now actually employ half or less than half of the number of people that they could employ, and the production in Iraq is half of what it could be if the situation was changed. Another problem and obstacles to our progress has been the lack of electricity and water that's under the current administration and security, which results in the both private and public sector workforce not being able to be as productive as it could be otherwise. And another problem that we face is this open borders to products and services from abroad, where many people are coming from abroad, and this affects local industries and local workforce and prevents them from developing fully locally. Examples of this are like most of the clothes factories and so forth in Iraq are not functioning because of ready-made clothes coming from all over the world, the same with refrigerators and other products that are now flooding into Iraq, where the average Iraqi cannot afford them, but also the average Iraqi is not working to be able to afford them.
What about privatization? Has there been much privatization so far under the American occupation?
We believe that privatization is very harmful to the Iraqi public in this stage of the game. We think that privatization is especially harmful when it deals with oil and public services such as health and education and so forth. So privatization is being prepared and being talked about, especially in line with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund coming into Iraq to provide loans conditional on privatization of these things like oil and other important sectors. In addition, there are about $18 billion that we heard of that various countries are supposed to donate to Iraq. Many of them may be conditional on being spent to private sector rather than public sector services. Yeah, most of these are programs that have not been implemented yet, awaiting basically an appointment of a new government that is supposed to be happening this year with the new constitution, and then privatization will kick in after that. That's at least what we hear is being planned.
You think that things wouldn't be any worse than they are now with the occupation if it were to end?
On the contrary, we believe the continuation of the occupation is what leads to further violence, and that there are many people who justify violence based on the presence of the occupation. So we have our own institutions that can take care of our own problems subsequent to the end of the occupation, but the occupation is certainly not helpful in this regard.
And what do you want the U.S. labor movement to do to support the labor movement in Iraq?
We hope that they would help us end the occupation as soon as possible, and upon end the occupation, that they would help us rebuild Iraq and the infrastructure of Iraq, which was devastated by this war.
That was Adnan Rashid of the Iraqi Federation of Labor, who just completed a speaking tour of the United States. Translation was provided by Mazin Kumsia. Contact the sponsoring organization, U.S. Labor Against the War, by visiting their website at www.uslaboragainstwar.org. Recent public opinion polls indicate that increasing numbers of Americans now oppose the Bush administration's decision to launch the Iraq War and the continuing bloody occupation. A Washington Post ABC News survey found that more than half of Americans believe the war has not made the U.S. safer. A Gallup poll also found 56% believe the war to overthrow Saddam Hussein's government was not worth the sacrifice, and 60% favor a reduction of U.S. troops deployed in Iraq. After the deaths of more than 1,700 American soldiers and news coverage of the British Downing Street memo that cast doubt on President Bush's stated justification for the war, some Democrats, as well as a handful of Republicans in Congress, are now openly calling for a timetable for a withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. President Bush strongly opposes such a move and reasserted in a June 28th national address his belief that there is a clear path to victory in Iraq. Over the past year, the U.S. peace movement has focused much of its energy on local organizing efforts. But anti-war groups are now planning for major protests this September in the nation's capital to give voice to the growing opposition to the war. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Leslie Kagan, national coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, who discusses the goals of the anti-war actions being organized by a coalition of peace groups for September 24th through the 26th in Washington, D.C.
United for Peace and Justice, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners will recall, is the largest anti-war coalition in the country right now. We have over 1,000 member groups all around the nation. And we decided actually back at our February National Assembly that in September it would be opportune and important to have a major anti-war demonstration. As things have unfolded, we've come to realize really how important it is. What we're planning to do is to have actually 3 days of anti-war activism in Washington, D.C. We decided this time to go to the nation's capital. And we're doing this on the weekend of September 24th. That's a Saturday, Sunday the 25th of September, and then we'll invite people to stay with us over to Monday the 26th. On Saturday, we'll do a mass, and we think this will be a massive turnout of people, march and rally. We're actually thinking of not doing the same old kind of rally that usually happens at these events, but something that's much more interactive, almost like a fair, a festival of resistance, an anti-war fair. Anyway, that will be on Saturday, and we already, momentum is building, and there's a tremendous amount of interest in this, and as I said, the timing is certainly right for it. On Sunday, Sunday evening, we'll do an interfaith religious service, and again, try and pull together a large event, where all the different religious orientations, will be part of the program. We also on Sunday, though, will be doing trainings for a lobby day at Capitol Hill, where people will be visiting their members of the House as well as their senators on Monday. So the training for that will be on Sunday. And also on Monday, there will be a nonviolent civil disobedience action, so the training for that will also take place on Sunday. And we're imagining that as we get closer, other activities, educational events, other protest activities will also be developed that will be part of the whole package of the weekend. Obviously, it's been important from day one that these kind of public protests happen, but there's so much, horrendous news every single day coming from Iraq. This war and the occupation continues unabated, that it's really, really critical that we put the pressure on the White House and on the Congress to do everything we can to force them to stop this war. What's really interesting about the timing is that things really seem to be shifting in the country. Not only are recent public opinion polls over and over again showing, a great majority, a growing majority of people in this country opposing the war and wanting it to end, but also there's cracks opening up in the Congress, in the policymaking circles in Washington. Things like the Downing Street memo that came out of London, a few weeks ago, reaffirming what we all knew, that is that the president lied about this war. So there's a whole lot that's going on that lead us to conclude that, not only is it important to maintain the day-in, day-out activism that so many people are doing around the country, but that it's time in the fall, and again, we've designated the weekend of September 24th, for people from not only the East Coast, but from wherever they can travel from all around the country to come together in Washington and send that strong message.
Leslie, what's the key message or demand coming out of these days of demonstrations in September?
Well, the key demand, the central demand, is the same one that we've had from the get-go, and that is we need to end the war in Iraq and our troops need to be brought home now. That has been United for Peace and Justice's consistent demand from day one. We've never wavered from that, and we still think it's the right demand. The war, this is a war that never should have happened. It's a war everybody, the whole world knows this is a war that was based on lies, and that the quickest way to end this war is to end it, is to declare, is to announce that, for U.S. policymakers to announce this war is over and we're bringing our troops home. And that's, we think, the quickest road to turning things around in Iraq. In that context of that major demand, there are other demands that we'll be making. For instance, we think it's time for military recruiters to get out of our schools. We know that our communities are being bankrupted by this war. So instead of, billions of dollars going into the war, we want money coming into our own communities and the programs we need funded. So there are, a number of connections that we will be making through the weekend, but the core central issue here is ending the war in Iraq and bringing our troops home.
That was Leslie Kagan, National Coordinator of United for Peace and Justice. Contact the nationwide coalition of peace groups by calling area code 212-868-5545 or visit their website at www.unitedforpeace.org. When the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, was debated and approved by the U.S. Congress in 1993, little was known about the trade treaty's effect on workers in America, Canada, and Mexico. But proponents of NAFTA promised that the agreement would boost the creation of high-paying jobs for thousands of Americans and lift millions of Mexicans out of poverty. More than 10 years later, critics of NAFTA point to data that indicates America has lost 900,000 jobs to cheap foreign labor, and 1.3 million small Mexican farmers have lost their land due to unequal competition with giant multinational agribusiness. Now, President Bush has renewed his call for Congress to ratify the controversial Central America Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA, that would eliminate trade barriers between the U.S., Costa Rica, the Dominican Republic, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. Critics fear that, like NAFTA, CAFTA could accelerate the loss of U.S. jobs, devastate small farmers, and encourage the proliferation of sweatshops. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Chris Slevin, Deputy Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, part of a coalition of fair trade and labor groups opposing CAFTA. He considers the winners and losers if the Bush administration should win its fight in Congress to ratify the Central American Free Trade Agreement.
CAFTA is NAFTA with a C. The fact that it rhymes is not a coincidence. It's 900 pages of text, and about 98% of it was a copy and paste from NAFTA. Congress started hearings on CAFTA a little over a month ago. It was actually an agreement that was signed by the Bush administration about 13 months ago now, and it's been sitting basically at the White House, and they haven't trotted it up Pennsylvania Avenue yet, just because there's been such a lack of support just among Democrats and Republicans, because they see that 11 years now of NAFTA haven't really added up to the promises. And so there's a lot of heat on members of Congress in their home districts, and just a lot of talk more about $660 billion trade deficit that's on the front pages more and more, and just seeing that the success of this NAFTA-style agreements around the world haven't really benefited the people that they said that they're going to be benefiting.
Chris, if the Central American Free Trade Agreement were signed into law like NAFTA was more than 10 years ago, in your view, who would the likely winners and losers be?
The likely winners would be, you know, the groups that are promoting it most, which is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. I think both proponents and opponents of CAFTA see this as part of a larger battle over trade policy right now. On its merits, CAFTA represents really a very small market. It's actually, there's been a statistic that has floated around for a while that the six CAFTA countries add up to the GDP equals that of New Haven, Connecticut. And it's seen as, you know, more of a struggle over how we're going to set trade policy in the future. NAFTA, a dozen years ago was more theory. It was looking ahead, and no one really knew. But now, you know, we have a dozen years of results, and so the style of trade that we'll have in the future, a lot will be determined in this battle over CAFTA. For anyone that's been following this closely sees that momentum has been with the critics of this model, and that there has been a broad-based coalition of groups that are opposed to this, which includes a lot of U.S. Latino groups, the League of United Latin American Citizens, the nation's largest Latino civil rights group, a supporter of NAFTA, has been outspoken against CAFTA, which has really resonated on Capitol Hill and in the press.
Certainly, the people in Central America are some of the poorest in this hemisphere, if not the world. And many people here in this country are concerned about the loss of jobs overseas after NAFTA's passage in 1994. So when an average worker in these two regions looks at CAFTA, what do they see?
I think, you know, workers in the U.S. who are, you know, following this debate see CAFTA as just more of the same policy. In Central America, as you mentioned, yes, is a very poor countries and countries that really, with the exception of, I'd say, Costa Rica, have among the worst labor rights records in the world, and this agreement does nothing to really improve that.
So, politically speaking, what is the president and supporters of CAFTA up against in the House of Representatives in particular, where it's going to come up first?
It's funny that you say that because, you know, a group like ours that's been following this for a while and others had expected the House of Representatives to take this up first. That may not be the case. The Senate may actually vote on this even later this week. And in the Senate, it's usually a pretty free trade friendly body where it'll pass probably with some ease. But politically in the House, yeah, it's more the chamber that hears more from local folks and knows the impact of trade agreements have been in their districts. And there are about 190 Democrats that are out against this right now. Right now, there's only five Democrats in the House that are supportive of this publicly. And there's, you know, a chunk of 30 to 40 Republicans who are opposed to this as well. And right now we're seeing the administration really try to build some momentum for it. That gets back to why they want to bring this up in the Senate first. You know, assuming that it passes in the Senate, they'll be able to point to that as being, you know, a success, a win, and try to see how well that carries over into the House. And there's a lot of deal-making going on, of course, as this administration is proved with lots of different parts of the Republican agenda. They will not likely bring something to the floor unless they're really close and know that they can push it through, and they're known to do it in the middle of the night when no one's watching.
That was Chris Slevin, Deputy Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, part of a coalition of fair trade and labor groups opposing CAFTA. Contact the group by calling area code 202-546-4996 or visit their website at www.tradewatch.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Sophia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Brian Gregg, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Adam Meyerowitz, Dino Pappas, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll be exploring the theme, the U.S. and human rights, Guantanamo and beyond. We'll be featuring an interview by Damon Thomas of Peter Somsich, head of the Seacoast, New Hampshire chapter of Amnesty International, and Frank Heffron, a retired lawyer in Exeter, New Hampshire, who works on human rights cases, the latest involving Murat Kurnaz, a young Turkish man who was detained by the U.S. in early 2002 and is still being held at Guantanamo Bay. And Tom Jackson will talk with John Hudson, President and Dean of Franklin Pierce Law School in New Hampshire, who is currently serving on the council for a case against Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld in relation to the human rights situation at Guantanamo Bay and other U.S. detention centers. Please join us. We leave you now with this quote by Edward Abbey. A patriot must always be ready to defend his country against his government.